February 12th, 2009, the posting date of this podcast, and the 200th birthday of Charles Darwin. This week, Jen continues its Year of Darwin celebration with an interview with Dr. Francisco Ayala, a world-renowned evolutionary biologist and geneticist from the University of California, Irvine. Dr. Ayala is interviewed by Jen's editor-in-chief, John Sterling, on the concept of natural selection, Darwin's most important contribution to evolutionary theory. This is the GenCast Network.
Dr. Francisco Ayala is university professor and Donald Bren professor of biological sciences, ecology, and evolutionary biology in the School of Biological Sciences at the University of California, Irvine. Dr. Ayala is one of the world's leading figures in the fields of evolutionary biology and genetics. He has published numerous scientific articles as well as several books on human evolution. His most recent book is entitled Darwin's Gift to Science and Religion, published by the Joseph Henry Press. Dr. Ayala, we are honored to welcome you as our special guest interview on Charles Darwin's birthday. You have written that Darwin's discovery of natural selection is one of the most significant events in intellectual history because it completed the Copernican Revolution. Would you elaborate?
In the 16th and 17th centuries, a great number of physicists, as we would call them now, Copernicus and Kepler, Galileo, eventually Newton, and many others, who initiated what is now known as the Copernican Revolution, that is, science in the modern sense of the world, science that proceeds by formulating laws and hypotheses and testing them by observation and experiment, and that looks for universal laws. Now, they have left the living world out of that revolution. They thought that their discoveries applied on Earth as well as in the heavens, so to speak, you know, that the same laws that explain the motion of bodies or the falling of bodies in Earth explained also the motion of the planets and the stars in the sky. But living organisms were clearly designed, you know, the eye designed to see and the hand designed for grasping, so they thought that could not enter into the explanation by natural laws, the discovery of universal laws that could account for the phenomena as observed in nature. It was the genius of Darwin that he discovered what has come to be known as natural selection, the law of natural selection, or the principle of natural selection, that more accurately should be called the theory of natural selection, as a way to account for the design of organisms, you know, why the eye has all the parts put together, which are clearly put together for the purpose of seeing, the same way as the parts of a watch are put together for the purpose of telling time. So natural selection can account for the design of organisms, and thereby Darwin brought into the realm of scientific explanation the living world that has been left out by the Copernican Revolution, and thus completed, so to speak, the Copernican Revolution, because now everything in the world of nature was explainable by scientific laws.
You also note in your recent book, which is entitled Darwin's Gift to Science and Religion, that Darwin considered natural selection, not evolution per se, as his theory, yet history, and many if not most scientists, probably credit Darwin for the theory of evolution. Why is this the case?
Well, it is all right to give credit Darwin for the theory of evolution, because he accumulated large amounts of information and evidence that supporting the theory of evolution. But evolution was frequently accepted by biologists at the time, and theories of evolution have been proposed for some time, most notably in 1809, the year of Darwin's birth, a French scientist known to us as Lamarck, have published the full theory of evolution. But most importantly was that many scientists in the continent, as well as in the United States and in Great Britain, were quite willing to accept evolution. What was not known at all was how to explain evolution, how to explain the change of organisms over time, and very importantly, how to account for design once again. And that idea, the idea of natural selection, came to Darwin very shortly after his return from a trip that he took around the world between 1831 and 1836. So we know that by late 1837 or early 1838, we know it from his notebooks, that he had come upon the idea of natural selection, and he was very excited, as it were, because he realized that he now had the explanation for design, and therefore for evolution. And he writes in his notebooks at the time, now I have a theory to work with. And thereafter, for the rest of his life, he conducted all sorts of observations and experiments, which could seem at first sight strange that he would be using up so much time, years at the time, in investigating certain matters like the fertilization of orchids or the classification of barnacles and things of the sort. He was looking for observations that could falsify his theory if his theory was wrong. That's the proper way of doing science, by the way, not trying to find evidence that is consistent with one's theory, but trying to find evidence that is contrary to one's theory. So he spent all the time looking for all these, doing all these observations and experiments and studies, and persuaded himself that his theory was correct. But again and again, his theory was the theory of natural selection, was the theory that explained design or adaptation, as we would say most frequently now in biological parlance, and therefore explained also evolution. But once again, his excitement was about the discovery of how evolution occurred, how design came about.
Although Darwin and Alfred Russel Wallace independently came up with the idea of natural selection, you've pointed out that they viewed the concept of natural selection rather differently. What were those differences, and how did those differences influence each man's understanding of the process of evolution?
Wallace was interested in explaining evolution, not in explaining design or adaptation. He was not aware that the main significance of the principle or the process of natural selection was that it could account for the design of organisms. He thought was a way to explain evolution, and in particular, progressive evolution. He thought that evolution was progressive, that always was moving forward, so to speak, and it would be always advancing. So something that Darwin, based both on evidence as well on the theory of natural selection, would not accept. So the paper of Wallace that was made public in 1858 and published that same year in the Journal of the Linnean Society, which is a very short paper, it's 5 or 6 pages, printed pages, just describes natural selection just correctly. But as differential reproduction, you know, some organisms that have some variations will leave more progeny than others. So that's correct. It's the process of natural selection. But Wallace was interested in explaining, as I said, progressive evolution, and was using it to explain progressive evolution, and never elaborated the concept of natural selection as a way to account for the design and adaptation of organisms.
Some people look at natural selection and see it as primarily a process that gets rid of harmful mutations, the kind of winnowing of the species in a negative sense. You've talked about natural selection also being a positive and creative process. Would you describe this aspect of natural selection in more detail?
Yes. First, let me make clear what you already stated. There are harmful mutations, and most mutations are harmful. Now, there are two ways in which a mutation can be harmful. One is because it interferes with some very basic aspect of the life of the organism, and those mutations are unconditionally harmful. There are other mutations that are harmful because they are not, they don't favor the adaptation of the organism to the environment. You have moths, say, in central Great Britain, in the forest there, who live by resting much of their time on the trunks of trees that are covered by lichens. The pattern of the wings of these moths are called peppered. It's a sort of a peppered pattern that makes them very inconspicuous while they are sitting on these trees. Now, if a mutation occurs that makes the wings of the moths black, these moths are going to be very visible to birds and possibly other parasites, and they will be eaten first. I am using this example because it's one that was very well studied in the middle of the 20th century. What had happened earlier, that is in the 19th century, starting with oil, concomitant with the Industrial Revolution, is that in many woods, in many forests of the central highlands of England, the pollution coming from the factories that were using coal had started to kill the lichens that covered the trees, and covered the trees instead with soot, so they will be black. So suddenly the mutation from the peppered configuration, the peppered pattern, to the black pattern that had been harmful before, now rather than harmful was beneficial. So that's the first point to make, that there are some mutations that may be harmful in one environment that may be beneficial in another. And that's one of the processes, therefore, that get involved in evolution, this replacement of mutations as the environment changes. Now, evolution can be creative, natural selection can be creative, because it builds upon previous mutations. So a mutation happens, for example, in some primitive mollusks that makes some of their epithelial cells, the skin cells, sensitive to light, and these mollusks are the organisms that include clams and squids and octopuses and the like. So these primitive mollusks that can now perceive light will benefit from that, but then new mutations may come along over evolutionary time that will now make not only the organism being able to perceive light, but to perceive the direction of light, and then to perceive the movement of other objects or other animals or plants around them, and so on. So mutations can accumulate, and we see the evolution of the eye in mollusks. That's why I have been using that as an example. As mollusks that live today, that some have these very primitive eyes, while other species have more and more elaborate eyes, and up to the squids and octopuses, who have eyes as complex and as elaborate and as accurate as the human eye is. So you can see there, by studying different species of mollusks, how mutations accumulate over time in different lineages, in different lines of descent, in different groups of organisms, gradually lead to more and more elaborate organs.
In relation to comparative anatomy and the fossil record, you argue that molecular biology provides the strongest evidence of biological evolution. how would you make this case to any comparative anatomists or fossil hunters if they were to sit down and have a glass of wine with you?
Well, probably they will agree with me to start with. I think that the molecular evolution does not exclude comparative anatomy or paleontology or fossil hunting. That also evidence is very helpful for us in understanding evolution. But in trying to prove that evolution has occurred and also the relationships, the evolutionary history among living organisms, molecular evolution is much more powerful because it has three attributes that are not present, at least not to the same degree, anywhere to the same degree in the other disciplines. These three attributes I call quantification, universality, and multiplicity. By quantification, I refer to the fact that DNA and proteins are informational macromolecules. That sounds like a mouthful. They are very large molecules. That's why they are called macromolecules. And they are called informational because they carry information in the sequence of the components, amino acids in the case of proteins, nucleotides in the case of nucleic acids, that is DNA. They carry information in the sequence of the components in the same way as a text, in English text, carries information in the sequence of the letters. So we can look at DNA, or we can look at protein, and say in the same molecule of DNA in different organisms, in humans, in chimps, in other monkeys, in cows, and anything else that you want, and you look at the sequence of letters in any particular molecule, and you can align the sequence of humans and the ones of chimps and monkeys and horse and what have you, align them and count the differences. So you have an exact measure of the amount of change that has taken place. It's as simple as that, as counting how many letters are different if you were to compare to very similar texts written in English. So there's quantification. The other advantage is universality. No fossil hunter and not anatomist can compare, say, an oak tree with bacteria and with monkeys. We can do it with DNA. We have many similar genes in completely all sorts of very diverse organisms. So when we study evolution, we can include all of life, from bacteria and other microbial organisms to plants, to animals, to everything else, and put them all in the same study, because for a given gene, the gene exists in all these organisms, so we can compare them directly. I said there is not much that one anatomist can do by comparing an oak tree with a human being, but molecular biologists can do a lot. Find a lot about their differences and their similarities. And finally, we have in molecular biology what I call multiplicity. That is, there are thousands of genes and thousands of proteins, restricting it to genes, to DNA. All those thousands of genes reflect the same evolutionary history. So if I want to compare, to reconstruct the evolutionary history of apes and humans, to stay with a relatively simple example. So we have there, the orangutan, the chimpanzee, the gorilla, and humans. Let us say we want to find out their evolutionary history. We look at the gene, we look at the segment of DNA, and count the differences and find out which ones are the two that are most closely related, and so on for the other species, less and less and less related. Well, if the first sequence of DNA, the first DNA, does not give us an answer that we think is accurate enough, or if we want to corroborate it, we go to another gene, and another gene, and another gene. So we can, as we compare more and more diverse organisms, we can increase the number of genes that we are studying and getting more and more accurate information about the evolutionary history. The amount of information, the molecular information in organisms, is virtually unlimited. So today, with molecular biology, we can reconstruct the evolutionary history of any group of living organisms with as much accuracy as we might want, so long as we are willing to invest, you know, time and resources.
You are a member of the National Advisory Council for the Human Genome Project. In addition to what many would consider the unexpected finding that humans only have about 30,000 genes, was there anything else that surprised you once the sequencing of the human genome had been completed?
Well, something related to what you said, the large amount of non-coding DNA, that is of DNA which is not involved in genes, we knew that there was a lot of it. Starting in the, I would say, the 60s, the middle 60s and through the 70s, there have been a number of people who had discovered the match of the DNA in all sorts of organisms, more in animals than in plants, was redundant or it was repetitive. So there were no clear-cut segments of DNA or portions of DNA that could be genes. But we never expected that, I never did expect, that the amount of repetitive and non-coding DNA, that is DNA which is not directly coding for proteins that are not strictly speaking genes, that there would be so large amount of non-coding DNA, you know, is huge, is a large majority. Well, another thing that is coming about, however, as this DNA, which does not encompass genes properly speaking, is being studied, is there are many segments of this DNA that seem to be involved in regulation, that is in activating or deactivating other genes. So this has been also a discovery that to me is fascinating, that there is such multiple layers of regulation, of instructions, as it were, for genes when they should be activated or not.
I want to turn to a couple of topics that you devote a good part of your book, Darwin's Gift, to. Why do so many Americans in particular seem to have trouble with the scientific theory of evolution and gravitate instead toward the concept of intelligent design?
Well, they think that evolution, that's a way with God and with their religion. And you know, we live in one of the most religious countries in the world, and unfortunately, this is the other side of the coin. Many people in the United States have very little or almost no scientific education, particularly as it concerns evolution. So they think that if organisms, including humans, have come about by natural processes, that seems to exclude God from the process, and they become sort of the defensive and say, well, the answer is to reject evolution. It must not be true because I believe in God and I think God exists and I want to have my religious faith. So that's unfortunate, because a point that I make repeatedly in the book is there is no necessary opposition between religion and science, and more in particular between faith in God and evolution. See, that organisms come about by natural processes does not necessarily exclude God any more than the fact that you and I have come about by natural processes excludes God from the process. You know, we know we were conceived in our mother's womb and an egg, and that our mother had was fertilized by sperm from our father, and that single cell developed into 2, 4, 8, and eventually an embryo and a fetus and a child comes about, and then we keep growing and carrying on with our life. and by transforming groceries into ourselves. It's all a natural process, and it does not need to exclude the presence of God in human life. So there's an analogy that I sometimes use trying to persuade people that they do not need to deny evolution to accept religion or deny religion to accept evolution. Ultimately, the problem is the one I was pointing at the beginning, that people have very little scientific knowledge and therefore interpret it in ways that are really unsatisfactory. And I must say that the ignorance concerning science includes very often, preachers and pastors and the like who are not knowledgeable about science. And again, they think that science, and in particular evolution, is materialistic and excludes God. It does not need to.
Looking back at intelligent design, you contend that intelligent design is both bad science and bad religion. How so?
Well, it's certainly bad science because there is not a single experiment or test or any valuable concept that would have been scientifically established. But let me talk about it's being bad religion. Even though the proponents of intelligent design, they think it's a way out of the materialism of evolution because we have been designed by God. That means God is there. We could not be designed by through natural processes. But think about it for a few moments, make people think about it for a few moments and realize the implications of that. If we have been designed by God, which is what the intelligent design proponents have in the back of their proposal, God would have a lot to account for, because starting with the fact that our jaw, our mandible, is not big enough for our teeth, so they have to remove our wisdom teeth, 1, 2, 3, sometimes all 4. Then the other teeth are crooked again because they don't fit well. The mandible is too small for the teeth. An engineer that would have designed the human jaw and the human teeth would be fired the next day. You don't want to blame God for that. And every part that we look at of a human being or any animal, plant, manifests defective design. Sometimes I say ID, which is how they like to initialize intelligent design. ID can stand for incompetent or inept design, but not for intelligent design, because organisms are incompetently designed, which is how natural selection designs things. Natural selection does not have foresight, so takes advantage of one mutation at a time. There's not an optimization process. There's taking advantage of whatever is available at a particular time. It's tinkering rather than engineering. It's taking advantage of what happens to be at hand, as it were, which is what the process of evolution does. So to give you one more example of incompetent design, take the human reproductive system. The head of the baby is too big for the birth canal of the mother. So millions and millions of children, innocent children, die at birth because of that inadequate design, and many millions of women too. Not to speak of the fact that shortly after conception, again for genetic reasons, because of the imperfections of the human reproductive system, some 20% of all the fetuses die during the first 2 months after pregnancy, by natural processes. You would not want to think that God has designed a reproductive system so that 20% of the unborn babies die. That will make God the greatest of all abortionists. People who are proponing intelligent design are doing that with the best of intentions. But for a scientist, somebody who understands evolution, who understands physiology and anatomy, to claim that we human beings have been designed by an intelligent designer makes absolutely no sense. And I will reiterate this for humans, and this for monkeys, and this for flies, and for trees, and everything is incompetently designed, which is how natural selection does things.
Dr. Ayala, you're one of the foremost advocates of the position that Darwin's gift, the concept of evolution by means of natural selection, and a belief in God are not mutually exclusive. How can a belief in a higher being be compatible with dyed-in-the-wool materialistic evolutionary theory?
Okay, how is faith in God compatible with, you said, materialistic evolutionary theory? Well, the key word there is materialistic. If by materialistic one means a process that doesn't take into account anything else other than what exists in nature, then evolutionary theory is materialistic. Now, philosophers sometimes speak of materialism in a different way, that is, a philosophy or a view of the world that denies that there is anything outside the natural world. Now, evolution does not imply that. Then evolution just explains the design of organisms and the change through time through a process which is a natural process, the accumulation of beneficial mutations over time. Now, that natural process is not more incompatible with belief in a supreme God than the materialistic process, I will use the same word you were using, of the development of an embryo into a human being that happens by itself, you know, through natural processes, and the child is born, and then the child grows and matures, and we don't need to invoke anything else to explain the development of a human being and the life of a human being as an animal, as it were, as a human being. We don't need to invoke anything else other than the natural processes. Now, once again, that does not exclude the existence of God or the presence of God in the universe or the presence of God in the particular human individual. The presence of God and the religious views of the world belong to a realm of reality, an aspect of reality which is different from the realm of the aspect of science. Science tries to describe natural processes. Religion deals with the supernatural and with God. We are talking about these two different aspects of reality, and they don't need to be incompatible. Anything that, anymore, and let me put an example that I hope it helps, not an example, an analogy, I hope it helps rather than hinders it. Think of a painting, Mona Lisa, everybody has heard of this masterpiece of Leonardo da Vinci. You know, you describe the Mona Lisa, all the pigments, and the size of the painting and the coordinates of every brush stroke. I mean, you can have a complete materialistic description of the painting. That does not exclude the artistic significance and the meaning of the painting. So this is something which belongs to a different realm of reality. It's another aspect of the painting. So you can have the materialistic description of the painting, and you can have the aesthetic description of the painting. One does not exclude the other. So I'm using this as an analogy to say that the materialistic description of the world, of nature, does not exclude the other possible explanation and account and description, which is the religious one.
I'm John Sterling. Thanks for listening. If you would like to comment on this week's podcast, please go to our podcast section at www.genengnews.com and give us your thoughts. We'd really like to hear from you. Bye for now.
To learn more about topics discussed in this GenCast, or to listen to previous GenCasts, visit our website at www.genengnews.com. New GenCasts are posted every week, Thursday, 5 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. For the Gen Publishing editorial staff, I'm Jonathan Ellinghouse saying thanks for listening, and be sure to tune in again next week to the GenCast Network.